Hello, and welcome to the final episode of the Our Science podcast in 2014. My name's David Chapman.
And I'm Katrina Ross. We'll be bringing you the latest goings-on from around the Royal Society, including our resilience report on extreme weather, and speaking to the shortlisted authors of the Royal Society's Young People's Book Prize. First, though, every 2 years we award the Royal Society Clifford Paterson Medal and Lecture to an engineer or scientist working in a modern and popular field like new media technologies or consumer electronics.
The 2014 prize winner was Professor Paulina Bavel, Professor of Optical Communications and Networks at University College London, and Programme Director of the Unlocking the Capacity of Optical Communications Project, also known as UNLOC, a joint enterprise between UCL and Aston University. The UNLOC project, funded by the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, aims to unlock the capacity of information systems to meet increasing demands for data transmission. She recently gave her lecture, Communicating with Light, about how data is transmitted with light and how our increasing demand for data means the internet is heading towards capacity crunch. We were able to speak to her afterwards.
My name is Paulina Bavel. I'm Professor of Optical Communications and Networks at UCL, and this year I delivered the Clifford Paterson Lecture. My lecture was focused on communicating with light, and there's different ways of communicating with light. For example, today the Rosetta mission is about to land on a comet that will use communication with light by transmitting information using lasers in free space. However, most information that's carried, most information that's transmitted these days that's generated by you and me and by big companies is carried over optical fibers. And communication over optical fibers fuses two concepts. One, guiding of light, transmission of light over long distances. And the second is communication using cables. Again, that dates back to the Victorian pioneers who first laid transatlantic cables over many attempts until they eventually succeeded in 1850s. But now, optical fibers form the web and the World Wide Web. They crisscross oceans, they're underground and over seabeds. And they form the backbone of the entire communications infrastructure. They underpin the internet. The internet cannot evolve unless we find new techniques in how to increase the information that is carried by optical fibers.
Perfect. And I know that you don't like the term capacity crunch and prefer, what is the term that we discussed when we spoke?
Capacity exhaust.
And what is capacity exhaust?
The rates at which we're all generating and consuming digital data are very high. They're much higher than the rates at which optical capacity is being installed, or capacity to carry digital data is being installed. And so since demand is exceeding capacity, at some point there will be capacity exhaust. At some point, one of two things will happen. Either capacity will become, communications capacity will become a commodity, a rare commodity, and will be rationed, or prices will increase. Either of those solutions is very detrimental to the digital economy that, again, is a big part of our GDP.
So what kind of technologies are you and your team working on to help mitigate the impact of capacity exhaust that we're approaching?
So one of the reasons why we're looking at capacity or one of the problems in transmitting information down optical fibers. Now, optical fiber communication channel is different to any other communication channel. It's non-linear. The radio channel is a linear channel. The optical fiber channel, optical fibers are made out of glass, and glass, silica glass, is a non-linear material. The refractive index of glass is dependent on the intensity of light that's shone down. So the more data we transmit, the greater is the intensity, the refractive index changes, and this in turn causes the signals to be distorted.
When you say that these optical fibers are non the more light, the more data that's going down them, the more and more they get distorted.
Exactly right. So now we don't just use one wavelength of light. We use many different wavelengths, so many different colours, just like in radio channels, you have one frequency for one channel, another frequency for another channel. In optical communications too, we use different properties of light to increase the amounts of information. So one way is increasing number of wavelengths. Another way is using other properties of light, frequency, polarization, phase, to increase the amounts of information. And the higher the intensity, the more data channels, the greater is the nonlinearity. And so we're trying to understand how, by using new physics, either by compensating for the nonlinearities, new materials, for example, we could undo some of the distorting influence, or by coding the information in a particularly new way, or by finding new coding algorithms and decoding algorithms, forward error correction, different modulation formats, so different ways of coding and decoding information combined with new materials and new ways of understanding nonlinearity, we can increase the amount of information can be transmitted.
If you want to watch Professor Babel's lecture, you can find it on our events page. There you can also find out about our upcoming events. Now, extreme weather has huge human costs that cannot be quantified. Changes in population size, the proportion of older people, and where people live, along with the impact of changes in climate, mean that people's exposure to extreme weather events is set to increase in the future.
So how do we reduce the impact of extreme weather today whilst preparing ourselves for future changes? What can we do to build our resilience? At the end of November, we launched a report produced by a working group of experts which investigates these and other key questions to help inform important decisions across the globe. Emma caught up with some of the working group at the launch.
So, Georgina Mace, the Royal Society's new report, Resilience to Extreme Weather, covers a lot of ground. If you could distill it into just a few key messages, what would they be?
So we're looking at the risks that are going to be faced by people roughly over the next century from what we're calling extreme weather. What we look at in the report is primarily floods, heat waves and droughts. And we look at relative risks using some new modelling and projections, but we also look at what the kinds of interventions and actions will be at local and government level to help protect people from those.
And why do you think now is the time to be looking at these issues?
So there are a few reasons why now's a very good time. One is, as we've seen from recent events, both in the UK and globally, we're not well protected against extreme weather now. We've seen major disasters affecting both developed and developing world countries, and the UK as well. So there's a reason, which is we just need to do something about this. We have a problem at the moment. The other reason is that next year, 2015, is an important year for several major intergovernmental agreements concerning climate change, disaster risk reduction, and the Sustainable Development Goals. And so we think now is a good time for governments particularly to build more coherent, better science and evidence-based plans to protect people all over the world from these events.
Great. And Peter Cox, the report contains some maps which show exposure to extreme weather events under future climatic and demographic change. Can you tell us a bit about the conclusions that can be drawn from those maps?
Yeah, we did something that sounds quite simple but gave surprising results, which is normally what you do with climate change is you look at area mean, so you might look at the mean warming over the globe or the mean warming over Europe. And we just thought to ourselves, well, if you're going to interested in the impact on people, it's best to look at the mean warming over people, basically what do people experience. So what we did is to take climate projections, like the ones in the latest IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, and then weight them by where people are now and in the future to get an idea of how many people are exposed to the different climatic extremes we were looking at. And what we found was that the normal story, which is climate change does exacerbate the risk of things like heat waves and floods and droughts. But the surprising thing was how much that was amplified by the fact that population was projected to change too. So population is growing in size, but also for some of these impacts like heat waves, the amount of the population that's elderly is key, and that is likely to be much, much larger in the future. So we found essentially a multiplier of the climate change risks associated with climatic extremes that was associated with the way the population was changing, growing and ageing.
Rowan Douglas, one of the things that the Royal Society's report looks at is integrating resilience into the global financial system. Can you tell me a bit more about this and tell me why you think that's such an important issue?
It's an important issue because disaster risk is now becoming a material risk to businesses as well as the private public sector around the world. But we need to find ways of getting that risk into decision-making, into business and into finance. Until we find a way of doing that, unfortunately, investments that we make and the cities of the future probably won't be built to be as resilient as they need to be, which will put capital and people at risk.
Thank you very much.
Following on from our resilience report, whether the weather presents us with explosive cyclogenesis, otherwise known as a weather bomb, other extreme weather events, or seemingly never-ending rain, it seems that one constant is that we never stop talking about it. Meteorological reports in the Society's archive date back to the very early days of the Royal Society, and even before.
On Tuesday the 9th of December, Professor Doug Parker from the University of Leeds led a Café Scientifique on what makes British weather worth talking about. We caught up with him to discuss the UK's number one conversation starter.
I'm Doug Parker, I'm a Professor of Meteorology at the University of Leeds. I'm also funded 50% by the Met Office, so as one of their joint professors. I study weather systems. I've worked on weather systems in Africa, in the UK, around the world really, and I like to use observations and models, so I'm a bit of a jack of all trades within the meteorological world.
Okay, so as our understanding of the complexities around weather increase, is that making it easier or harder to predict the weather?
So in terms of weather prediction, I think it's clear that the weather predictions are improving. So as we understand the complexities and also as our technology improves, so as we get better observations and particularly from satellites, but better computer models as well, bigger computers, then our weather forecasts are improving all the time. And weather forecasting is a big industry in a sense. It has a big economic value, estimated at billions of pounds per year. And it's really driven by success. So it's strictly measured, the outcomes of that process. So certainly our understanding of increasing complexity is leading to better forecasts through this very carefully regulated process. I think the same cannot necessarily said about climate prediction, because in terms of climate prediction, it's much harder to do the evaluation. So as our models become more complex, that does add dimensions of uncertainty to the future climate.
You just mentioned there that you have markers of success that your that models are measured against. So as a layperson, why do I think that weather reports in the UK, or at least where I am in the UK, are so often wrong?
Well, there are a number of answers to that, and in fact, this is a central theme of what I want to talk about today at the meeting at the Royal Society, the Café Scientifique. I think that the customers of weather forecasts are very diverse. So the weather forecasts are used by very many different people doing in different walks of life. The biggest and the ones which have the biggest economic value, particularly in the short term, are shipping and aviation. And those customers are really, really interested in the wind patterns. So for aviation, they want to know the winds at different heights in the atmosphere, so they can burn fuel efficiently, they can fly downwind, and that has significant economic impact. So those customers are getting very good service, they're getting very high quality forecasts. Until recently, forecasts were measured in terms of those kind of customers. So we measured the forecasts in terms of the quality of the winds 5 kilometres up in the atmosphere. But of course, for the average person in the street, for the general public, that's not such an interesting measure. unless it shortens your flight time when you go on holiday. But on a day-to-day basis, you're not interested in the winds at 5 kilometres. And what you care about is the weather at the surface, in the lowest 2 metres of the atmosphere, which is where we live. And so the processes down there are quite different. And the physical processes that determine the weather that human beings experience in their everyday lives are dominated by other kinds of physics. And in particular, the physics of clouds is very important to us. So even though the Met Office may get a really excellent forecast of the high and low pressure systems and the winds on a given day, there's usually a very delicate balance of physics that determines what the weather is in terms of clouds. So the difference between an overcast day where there's complete cloud cover and it's quite cool at the surface, and that cloud cover breaking up and the sun shining at the surface and everything warming up and it being quite nice, is often physically very, very narrow margin. And that's really hard to get right. So those are the kind of challenges that we're trying to drill down to at the moment, is to try and really quantify the physics better and to model it better so that we can get those details right.
But going back to the point that airlines might be quite concerned about knowing about changing weather patterns at high altitudes, when will we switch to being more proactive?
Yeah. That is a very complicated social and political question. I would like to imagine that we will make use of good information, and much better information is coming all the time. I mean, this is the heart of the climate change question, is understanding what regional climates will do. So I'd like to think that we could use that information to adapt our social and political structures. So for instance, changing building codes and regulations for safety, for instance. It may be, however, that we do end up being responsive. And in those cases, I think there are commercial interests who will respond. So particularly the insurance industry is extremely interested in any convincing evidence of changes in the statistics of extreme events, because they're the ones that end up paying out if they make their estimates wrong. So if there are changes, and the insurance industry watch that carefully, and they hopefully will push society to take proactive action.
Will we ever stop talking about the weather in this country?
Well, I hope we don't stop talking about the weather in this country. I think it's a pleasure, actually. I was thinking about this before coming down here, but it's one of the things that unites us, isn't it? And it's also a leveller, I think, because you can talk about the weather with anybody. We all have the same experience. It's above our heads. Rich or poor, it's above our heads day and night. It affects us all equally, and it's something, I think, also that you don't have to be a professional scientist to have an opinion on the weather. We all live through it all the time, and we all have experience of it, and I think it's a wonderful thing that we can discuss it.
Last month, we awarded our Young People's Book Prize to author Clive Gifford for his book Eye Benders: The Science of Seeing and Believing. Earlier this year, we interviewed all of the shortlisted authors to find out more about them and their books. Let's see what authors Christian Durian, Katie Daines, and Jill Arbuthnot had to say. Okay, so Christian, your book How Animals Live has been shortlisted for the Royal Society Young People's Book Prize this year. Congratulations, first of all, for making the shortlist.
Thank you very much.
Is science something you've always been interested in and written about?
Well, actually, my background is in geography. But I think the books I write are everything: geography, science, English, because I like to look at things as a whole. So for me, it's interesting that they've been labeled as science. But the more I find out about it, the more I am interested in science. But it's interesting that it could be anything, because it's about the world around us.
We've got a few questions from the judging panels around the country.
Yes.
So I'll just give a selection of them here. This is from the Holyrood panel, and from Izzy in particular. So she asks, how do you make this book so exciting yet full of facts and interesting at the same time? Do you prefer writing about facts or exciting stories?
That's such a good question, because that is the challenge of these books, and that's what I love doing. You start with pages and pages of research and facts, and you have to select the fact that would be interesting to people. And often it's things that we don't know, that are not so obvious. There needs to be an element of surprise in all the books. And so my books are non-fiction, so they're not about stories. And often you know, it's harder to make them interesting because you don't have a story. But I just love finding amazing information that nobody knows. That makes the book different, I think.
Congratulations for making the shortlist, first of all.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really chuffed to be included.
So the prize is to celebrate science books, and particularly science books for the under 14s. Have you always written about science, or is that something that you've come to more recently?
I've written several books about science. I've done another book on the human body and a book on space. And I've actually recently finished a book called Sea Inside, Weather and Climate. So that involved me getting my head around a lot of science. Mm. I do enjoy writing about science.
Yeah. But you're not from a traditionally science background?
No, so I've got an arts background. And I think that, in a strange way, helps because it means I can approach a science topic with a fresh outlook on it and without any kind of prior knowledge, and hopefully therefore make it more accessible to children themselves who are coming to it perhaps for the first time. I work closely with a designer, Susie Harrison, and we have quite a fun time taking the information, thinking how do we present this on the page. And this is where the flaps are extremely useful, because with this book it's questions on the top layer and then the answers underneath. So the answers are hidden away, and that's that sort of anticipation, and there you don't know what you're going to find underneath, so hopefully an element of surprise there as well. One thing I love is when the illustrations come in. So we work with Marie-Yves Tremblay. She's not in the publishing house with us. She lives in Canada, and she'll send the an email with an attachment, and her work's done digitally, and you open it up, and it's just fantastic to have this gorgeous colour artwork on your screen. Yeah. And she puts in so many nice details, the expressions on the faces, the little additional doodles. That's really charming to see, and it makes you feel the book's really coming together.
I've been a biology teacher for a hideously long time, but always at the back of my mind I wanted to write. And eventually I decided I'd better get on and try and do this seriously. And I started off writing for adults initially, fiction, and got nowhere with that. Then wrote a children's fiction book, which was accepted. And the writing took off from there. And then a fellow author said, "Have you thought of writing a science book?" And I thought she meant a textbook. And I remember vividly saying, "I would sooner stick needles in my own eyes," because writing a biology textbook was the last thing I ever wanted to do. But she said, no, she said, "A book that people might actually want to read." Mm. And I thought, well, actually, that's a good idea, because I am very, very enthusiastic about science. I think it's thrilling, and it ought to be the kind of thing that brings you up short with excitement. And not many school books do that, so I thought, hey, I'll try and write a science book that somebody would actually pick up for pleasure. I've always been enthralled by the hunt for DNA, for the structure, the whole Wilkins, Watson, Crick, Franklin story. And it took off from there. And there's so much happening so quickly. And it's not always well reported in the papers. And for the generation who's growing up now, it's going to be vital that they actually understand what's going on and they can make reasoned decisions, because there are going to be some very difficult decisions, I think, as our capabilities become greater. So I wanted to write a book that would intrigue people and thrill people, but also that would give them information that was correct and understandable, so that they can begin to think their way through the challenges, I think.
We are now accepting entries for publishers for the 2015 prize. So for a chance of being on next year's shortlist, visit royalsociety.org/awards/young people.
In 2015, the Society is marking the 350th anniversary of Philosophical Transactions, the world's first scientific journal, with a whole programme of events. On 6th of March, we're launching a series of films celebrating the journal and its impact on science and the world around us, as well as special issues of the journal featuring reviews of landmark papers by experts and popular science writers. There will also be debates about the future of publishing, a webcast discussion meeting on the bio-inspiration of new technologies, and a partnership with Young Scientist Journal to get science projects in schools written up as scientific papers. Ahead of these and other events, a new exhibition has opened up at Carlton House Terrace, the Society's London headquarters, on the history of scientific publishing at the Society. It highlights some of the huge changes that the journal has undergone, and in some cases, caused to the way science is done. It also showcases some of the more colourful episodes in its history.
So if you're interested in a report calling Charles Darwin's only paper in the journal long-winded, how a president oversaw the journal being reformed after public parody, or a note from a very rushed Lord Kelvin that approves a paper by Maxwell to be published, you should schedule a visit. Visit our website for more information. We talked to two historians from the University of St Andrews, Dr Julie McDougall-Water and Dr Noah Moxham, who have been working at the Society's archive for the last 18 months, to find out why the journal has survived and remains so prestigious for so long.
The Philosophical Transactions was the first scientific journal in the world, so it's important because of its origin, but it's also important because it's the longest running journal.
It inaugurates the single most important new literary form of the last four centuries, which is the scientific journal article. There's no other mode of writing that's had more impact.
So the exhibition is Philosophical Transactions, 350 years of publishing at the Royal Society.
Well, this large man in clerical dress and with very sort of fine fingers splayed across his chest is Henry Oldenburg. He was a minor diplomat, and he worked in London as a tutor to the sons of English nobility. He would accompany them on their grand tours of the continent. And in the course of doing that, he acquired a fairly fabulous contact book.
Yeah, so he was obviously the first secretary to the society in 1660, and he was also the founder of the Philosophical Transactions in 1665. So he's obviously really important in the history of the journal.
That is the title page to the first bound volume. The issues came out monthly, but the parts could be bound together, and Oldenburg had a separate title page printed for collectors who wanted the entire volume together. This is a presentation copy. It's inscribed to the society by the author. Oldenburg referred to himself as the author rather than the editor.
And it's not only looking kind of at the content of the journal, but it's actually looking at the backstory and the editing and especially the reviewing practices that were going on and who was involved in actually managing the journal on a day-to-day basis. And the archive at the Royal Society provides a really rich resource for this.
So it's issue number 27 from July 1667. And the thing about this is that it was published while Oldenburg was imprisoned in the Tower of London. England was at war with the Dutch Republic at this time, and Oldenburg was thrown in jail on suspicion of passing information to the enemy. The Royal Society's charter allowed him to correspond freely with the continent even during times of war, but apparently either somebody forgot that or somebody decided that he'd crossed a line, because he was languishing in prison while this came out. It's not clear at this point whether it was simply somebody taking advantage of Oldenburg's imprisonment to try and cash in, or whether it was somebody trying to be helpful and actually to maintain the unbroken sequence. Either way, Oldenburg felt compelled to repudiate the issue when he emerged from prison at the end of August.
So they can expect to find some interesting stories, interesting figures in the history of the journal. I think they can also expect to see some of the most important papers that were published there. I think they can hopefully expect to be slightly surprised in terms of our representation of different sides of the journal, its editing practices, but also some of the individuals who are lesser known, including some of the female authors. Yeah, okay, so here we have a list of the first female authors, some of the first female authors to be published in Transactions. The first one we have on the list is Caroline Herschel, and then we have Mary Somerville, who's quite well known, and then there are three other individuals, Grace Franklin, Helen Classen, and Charlotte Scott, up until the 20th century. So Alice Lee is really interesting. So she published in the Transactions in 1901, and she had been working with Carl Pearson on a PhD at UCL, and this paper that she publishes is based on her PhD, which is also very interesting because what she does is she's trying to kind of disprove the hypothesis at the time that there was a relationship between cranial capacity and intellectual ability, and she does this by kind of measuring the skulls of some of her contemporaries at the time, so mainly male colleagues at UCL, including her boss, Carl Pearson. And what she finds is that actually those that you expect to have large skull capacity and so be most intelligent have much smaller skull capacity than some of the like less senior individuals in the university and in her field. So she kind of proves this in a kind of, I guess, not ironic, but she's sort of saying, you know, this can't be true because it doesn't apply to you and you're considered to be, you know, some of the most intelligent men. And
my name is Aileen Fife. I'm a historian at the University of St Andrews and I work on the history of science and technology, particularly the history of science communication and publishing. It's the first periodical that was focused specifically on the natural sciences that were then known as natural philosophy and natural history. But one of the great things about it is not merely that it was the first to do this, but that it is still with us today.
Yeah, so this is George Gabriel Stokes, and he was a physicist and mathematician, and he was based at Cambridge, and he was secretary to the society between 1854 and 1885. So he's actually the longest running secretary. And yeah, he was really important in establishing the refereeing processes and kind of making them more formalised.
We can find something that looks very like peer review going all the way back to 1665. Henry Oldenburg didn't particularly trust himself to evaluate mathematical papers, and he had a couple of reliable colleagues who he would send papers to for evaluation. So John Collins initially, and later after Collins died, John Wallace, who was the civilian professor of geometry at Oxford. But from 1831, the system starts to become a lot more systematic.
So this is James Clerk Maxwell's paper on a dynamical theory of the electromagnetic field.
The most important paper ever published in the Philosophical Transactions by most people's calculations. I mean, the single most important original discovery. And this is James Clerk Maxwell's paper in which he posited for the first time that light was an emanation of the electromagnetic field. So this is an image taken from an engraved plate, which was the standard technique of illustration in the early field trans. And what it's showing is, it's showing two different things, actually. It's showing a solar and a lunar eclipse from the mid-1660s.
About 250 years later, we have this photograph. Can you tell me what this is and what paper it's from?
Well, what we're looking at is an image of a solar eclipse during the transit of Mercury, which is to say the passage of Mercury across the solar disk. And that's a fairly trivial occurrence in itself, but this paper was important because it was used to demonstrate, it was one of the very first experimental demonstrations of general relativity. Essentially, the scientists who observed this, Eddington and Dyson, would have expected Mercury, according to Newtonian physics, to appear in a certain spot. And in actual fact, it appears elsewhere, and that's the effect of gravity actually bending the light.
For me as an academic, it's so special because it's got a 350-year archive, and there's, I think, no other journal, scientific or otherwise, that has got that paper trail behind it. So that's a really marvellous thing for me to investigate.
It's just an astonishing idea. It's incredibly diverse, flexible. It was quicker than all previous modes of communication. And I think its importance can be demonstrated as simply as you like by the fact that it is still the normal way of communicating.
And we heard there from Dr. Julie McDougall-Waters and Dr. Noah Moxham, also joined by Dr. Aileen Fife, who's the principal investigator on the Publishing the Philtrans project from the University of St Andrews, funded by the AHRC. And you can find out more about other activities in the Publishing 350 programme in episodes to come in 2015. My name's Stefan Janusz, by the way.
Finally, at the end of November, the Royal Society hosted the first Commonwealth Science Conference in almost 50 years. Scientists from over 30 Commonwealth countries travelled to Bangalore, India, for the three-day event. President of India, Pranab Mukherjee, inaugurated the conference at an opening ceremony attended by the Royal Highness Duke of York and Commonwealth Secretary General Kamalesh Sharma. With so many scientists from different disciplines and parts of the world in one place, we couldn't help but ask, why science? This is what Dr. Moses Laman had to say.
Okay, I'm Moses Laman. I'm from Papua New Guinea, and I work for the Papua New Guinea Institute of Medical Research, currently based in Australia, doing PhD, completing my PhD. I think science is very important because science doesn't have any boundaries. It can unite us from developing countries as well as those from developed countries, and it is the passion for science that drives us to do these things that we do. And I like one of the presenters, Rao, who said that your money doesn't matter, and as well as politics doesn't matter. In science, it is the people who have the passion for it that really drives science. And for me as well, I think this is the kind of science that I also love.
That's it for this month, but join us again in the new year for the next episode.